I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome to the Mr. Beacon podcast. Wonderful to have you with us. This next segment is going to be an interesting one. The very first company that we interviewed on the Mr. Beacon podcast years and years ago was this British company called Pointer. Over 140 episodes later, I thought it'd be really interesting to have them back on the show and to do a checkpoint on where they are, and they're doing really well. So stand by and have a listen to Paul DuPont, who's one of the executives at Pointer, and hear a bit about the use cases that are really moving the needle in terms of indoor location, indoor navigation, and RTLS. We'll hear a bit about his history, which is a fascinating one, how he got his role at Pointer. And I think it's a good educational moment to get a sense of how this company has survived, why it's survived, and where they're seeing success. Where is the gold buried in this Internet of Things landscape that we're traversing? Before we go on to that, I'm going to take a brief commercial break. Normally, our sponsorship notices are pretty light. We have the occasional ad that goes on, and the money goes from those ads. Currently, at least, is going to the Monarch School for kids, for homeless kids here in San Diego. And the sponsorship that we get from Williot just allows me to keep this show going on and provide some of the resources required to get it out there. So a quick commercial break for us here at Williot. Williot has just launched its first ever starter kit. So up until now, Williot, this company that I work for, my day job, where we make computers the size of a postage stamp that power themselves by harvesting radio frequency energy, and now the cloud system that is connecting those tags and providing the sensing data, doing amazing things. That has always been our customers have always been some of the largest companies in the world, and typically it costs a lot of money to get into our early adopter program. You're talking $50,000, $100,000 to get access to this product that we think is going to change the world. Well, now that price has come down to $500. So we've got to the point with our version 2 product where the product is maturing. It's still not 4.0, 5.0, but we're seeing amazing results. Tens of thousands of tags being deployed on items of apparel and plastic crates, cardboard boxes, and things that previously weren't connected to the internet are now being connected, and the sensing and automation that's all integrated. So, fine words, but people often want to know, does it work? And the answer is, it depends on what you want to do. How do you find out more? Well, you can actually buy a starter kit for $500, go to williot.com. And if you want to go directly, you go to williot.com/starter-kit, starter kit, and you can be one of the first to get your hands on this technology that we think is going to help solve climate change, make food better, medicine safer, and open up some incredible new business models for companies that sell ordinary things rather than expensive things that can now be connected to the internet. So that's the end of our little commercial break. Now on to our friends at Pointer. The Mr. Beacon podcast is sponsored by Williot, intelligence for everyday things, powered by IoT Pixels.
So this week's guest is Paul DuPont of Pointer. Paul, welcome to the show.
Nice to be here, Steve.
Well, it's actually a very special, poignant episode having you on. It's kind of unusual in a number of ways, but one of them is that our very first episode back in 2016 was interviewing Chris Charles, who at the time was at Pointer, and I was over in London visiting here from the States, and it was a great discussion, I thought, and that was episode one, and I think this will be like the 139th episode. So, you know, I was going to say bookends, but we actually do intend to continue the podcast. But certainly, I think, very interesting. Pointer is a super interesting company. Well, A, you're still around. So how many IoT Beko system companies from 2016 are still around? There's a lot that have fallen by the wayside. So you're doing some things right. And you focused on indoor positioning, navigation, location, and I think some asset tracking as well. We'll get into all of that. So these use cases have evolved a bit since 2016. So I'm looking forward to our discussion. So maybe we should start off with just introducing for people that didn't listen to episode one of the Mr. Beacon podcast. Who are Pointer, and what do you do?
I think the company has probably evolved since the first interview in 2016. Although I think the core product, though better, is largely the same. So firstly, I'm Paul. I head up sales for Pointer. And the company, the main product that we have is software for indoor positioning. And then the services that kind of wrap around that. So with that, it's essentially a blue dot that shows accurate user location on a mobile device. That's the core of our product that uses beacons in order to enable that. But then, you know, as you said, we also have a range of other products around that, be it mapping or be it some asset tracking functionality as well that tie that into kind of a broad solution.
So I was scanning your website looking to see what's changed, and I saw you'd coined the term DLAAS, Deep Location as a Service.
That's right.
Well done for confusing people even more about this as a service stuff. But I do like the deep location tag. It implies something that we should all have. What is the difference between deep location and regular indoor location?
So you can thank our marketing team for that. It's our twist on indoor location or indoor positioning, which revolves around being scalable and being software focused, right? So it's the core concept that we have is that our product is designed to be able to be deployed anywhere and very quickly in an indoor environment, versus some other indoor location solutions which might not have that depth of ability.
And why can your solution be deployed faster than any other solution?
We have a variety of nice little things that we do that enable us to do that. So the first of which is the way the technology works. So the algorithm or the SDK that goes into the mobile device, you know, via our client's app, does the positioning on the device itself, using the beacons around it, which means it doesn't need to do any fingerprinting. It doesn't need to access the internet at all. And it means that when we do a deployment, we can just use either, for example, existing infrastructure that's already there, or we can just go in and place beacons as necessary. And something that we've got very good at doing during the pandemic is we train our clients to put the beacons up themselves. So we don't even need to go on site to do deployments. Which I think is...
So you said you don't do fingerprinting. So, you know, what is fingerprinting and how do you avoid doing it?
So fingerprinting is the process of when you're doing an indoor location deployment, walking around with a mobile device and collecting radio signal strength as you wander the floor. So the device collects it says that in you walk a fixed route, and along that route it says at this point I detect the RSSI strength of beacons or Wi-Fi or geomagnetic or whatever.
So that's the received signal strength.
That's right.
Beacons, yeah. But normally you walk around, you'd be kind of recording the signal strength, and presumably you'd be doing some indication of where you are on a given floor plan at the same time.
That's right. So you mark where you are. It ties it together with the field strength around you. Then that gets turned into essentially a fingerprint, right? You'd look at a floor plan and you'd see, much like on a finger, you'd see grooves and peaks where the signal strength varies. So over a short period of time, let's say 3 to 6 months or so, that signal strength doesn't vary so much. So you can upload that signal to the cloud, and then when a user wants to explore the area, they download the fingerprint, and then your mobile device will compare the signal strength, the field signal strength around you with that fingerprint, and then place you on top of that location. That is good. Yeah, I think that's what we call like an infrastructure-free deployment, which is something we don't do, or one using, for example, like existing Wi-Fi. What happens is over time, as you move furniture around, or as a Wi-Fi AP breaks, or as somebody doesn't, that fingerprint changes, and it means that you need to walk around and do the fingerprint again. So the advantage to our technology is we don't do that at all. The beacons, which are placed either in, for example, like a Wi-Fi AP in the lighting or standalone, they get installed in the ceiling. We log them where they are. In our point of cloud, which is our back end, and then the mobile device will do a calculation based on when it hears those beacons, but it will also combine it with the gyroscope or the step counter, the inertial sensors on the device in order to produce that blue dot. So it doesn't. So you know, one client deployment that we did in 2017, I went to go visit in beginning of 2020, you know, we'd not been there, we'd not touched it, we'd not done anything, and the blue dot was still working exactly as it should be, you know, giving high accuracy. That's our main point of pride.
Very good, and that's something that's evolved presumably over time to be a differentiator. One of the perennial issues with location platforms is kind of the boundaries, boundary between floor one and floor two, because sometimes signals tend to kind of get confusing, especially when you're going up staircases and that sort of thing. And you know, if you're doing navigation and the dots kind of moving around or in the wrong place, then in key transitions from one floor to another, that can be a real problem. So how do you approach multi-floor? Is there something better about what you do versus other people do with respect to that?
Yeah, so transitions, be they up, down, or for example, indoor, outdoor as well. These kinds of transitions are stuff that we like to think we're the best at. So when it comes to floors, again, using the inertial, right, so actually to go back to your original point, so with floor level transitions, especially places with mezzanines or variable height ceilings, which there are more and more of in new builds, right? Like new builds are crazy beautiful buildings with all kinds of environments that make it very difficult for anybody in the radio world, right? Which is
like a shopping center, which has open space where the radio waves can propagate, but you know, all sorts of different heights and quirkiness.
Or airports with solid walls made entirely of aluminium sheets, that sort of thing. I think it can make life difficult. So what we have is, because we use the inertial sensors, we know whether the user has jumped or not, right? And by and large, they tend not to randomly jump between floors. So we can use the step counter on iPhones, for example, and I think some Android devices, we can use the barometer to check for like pressure level changes or if somebody's moving up and down. And it gives a really smooth and natural transition as you go between floors. It's a real. Many of our customers had an awful experience in the past with a blue dot that would jump between floors, and it's actually one of the main reasons that people will eventually come to us.
Yeah, we were talking before this about the second surgeon phenomenon. You go, you have your knee done with the doctor that's just down the road, and it's terrible, and you then actually do the research and you find the people that are the real specialists that are the best in the business. And I think you would claim to be the second surgeons of indoor positioning, right? It seems like a lot of your business comes after people have had a bad experience with something else.
Yeah, I think probably the majority. Certainly our bigger resellers, people who take our technology and package it into their own products and then resell it on, I think all of them had an unsatisfactory experience with a blue dot that jumped or wasn't consistent or wasn't accurate or wasn't easy to deploy, and we've replaced them. In a sense, that's good because we're certainly not the lowest cost provider out there, but we don't try to be. We want to be the best, and so. We'll participate in a bid, and then maybe 18 months later, we'll then participate in the replacement bid. It happens quite a bit.
So, what can you say about pricing? How much detail can you give us about the pricing approach? I think people who look at the industry are interested. Presumably, it's some kind of subscription.
Yeah. So. For the service, we break it down into different products. So we have our professional services, and then we have our licenses and support. Our professional services, for example, include installation, creation of maps, some software services or customizations as required. Then we have our licenses, which are what we call blue dot and geofencing, which is purely we give you a blue dot and we put it inside your app. So sometimes some of our customers, they use it to track mobile devices, for example. They don't actually want to display to the user where they are on there. They just want to get the information, then pump it up to the cloud so that they can do analytics or whatever. Then we add another layer on top, which is maps and wayfinding, which is where we take the blue dot and then we create some maps, and we put the blue dot on top of the maps, and then we enable the wayfinding. So that would be, for example, in shopping malls or in airports, well, for many different places, but so far that's where we've deployed our maps and blue dot the most. And then we have analytics on top of that, so understanding where people went, how they move around, and then finally asset tracking, which is a different sort of thing. All of those products are driven by the area that we deploy. So we calculate the square footage, and then we have a square foot price that we multiply by the unit price, and then we have our deployment price. For some clients who have thousands of venues, we wouldn't be looking at square foot pricing because it wouldn't make sense for them. It would be more like per venue pricing. So, you know, we can be a bit flexible, but our square foot pricing is where it all starts.
And what about numbers of users? If I have one user or a million users, is it the same? Or?
Well, we don't want to penalize people for using the product. If you see what I mean. So we want as many people to use it, so we don't charge a per user fee. The world of real estate, which is where we're seeing the majority of growth right now, office real estate, workplace, everybody's going back to the office. That whole world is dominated by square foot pricing, which is why we fit into that category.
So if I'm an airport, how much does it cost to get indoor navigation?
Are you a big airport or a little?
I'm a medium-sized airport. I'm Portland Airport, San Diego Airport, something like that. It's not Heathrow. Heathrow is a customer. Who is your customer?
Isn't Gatwick. In the world of airports, I have to be a little careful, I think. Gatwick, certainly. Then in the US... So we're in the United app, providing location. We do some stuff at JFK, in Dubai Airport, Airport in Doha. I think there's 22 in total, or maybe 23 now.
I'm just sort of trying to get a rough sense of what it costs to. Thinking about the. And maybe I'm just going to have a list of the shops in my airport, or no, maybe I'm going to have navigation to help people find the lounges and the toilets and the shops, which can make me more money because that's how airports make money, or one of the ways they make money, at least. Big shopping malls with planes attached.
Well, that's pretty much it. So usually there is an app, as you said, which we don't develop. Our customer will develop their own app, and then we just put our technology into that app. App production is, is an expensive business, and it's also highly customized, configurable. Which our team is all about hammering out this one product at scale, right? All about indoor positioning, so it's not about customizing them. So, I mean, an airport, depending on the infrastructure that's already in place, if you've got an app already and then you want to put in positioning, it can be anywhere between 50,000 to a quarter of a million, depending on what you've got in there.
A year or?
That would be a year.
And one of the things you talked about was depends on the infrastructure. So some airports, like San Diego Airport, deployed a bunch of Qualcomm beacons, gimbal beacons. Oh my goodness, I'm part of the gimbal team. I forgot the name of the product. what beacons do you work with? What beacons do you work with?
Well, we work with any kind of beacon. We love to work with beacons that are already in infrastructure. Because a beacon that's in the Wi-Fi AP or in the lighting is one that doesn't need a battery and is already there, and everybody loves that.
But what about beacons like Eddystone Ephemeral ID or gimbal beacons? They're constantly rotating the they use randomized MAC addresses and the payloads are encrypted. And how do you deal with that?
So by and large, we use iBeacon format, unless there's a particular reason to use another format.
Okay.
We can manage encryption or, you know, rotating beacons as long as we also have access to that rotation.
The API. So you'll integrate with the APIs of the people that have the encrypted beacons.
If needed. Okay. It's very rare that it's needed, but if we have to do it, then we have to do it.
Yeah, I think more encrypting on assets, you know, where my assets are is kind of sensitive, but it's not really a secret that you're in San Diego Airport or the Apple Store, you know, the famous first mass deployment of Bluetooth beacon technology in a commercial environment was in the Apple stores all across the United States. That's something that that we did at Qualcomm. And there was debate about how confidential is it that you're in an Apple store. It's not very confidential, really.
Well, yeah, so retail, workplace, transport, those are not particularly confidential. Where it does get important is in gaming. So casinos, what they call them, bookies, or what's the word for it?
If you're on a race course and there's rules about whether you're allowed to bet or not, and you can bet if you're in the race course, but if you're not on the race course, then that's not okay. So why is encryption important in that case?
Exactly for that reason. There are some countries with laws that say you are only allowed to place a bet within a certain area, so a physical space, and casinos or sportsbook companies look for ways to provide gaming services through their mobile app. Of course, that means that they need a way of checking that you're in that facility. So we would then provide beacons to say, you know, the blue dot only exists when you're inside this facility. You need a way to make that spoof proof, because otherwise, you know, there's two things that could happen. One is somebody could physically steal a beacon and take it home. So you need a way to prevent that from happening. And then the other is that they could emulate the beacon at home. So they could download the UID or whatever and then copy that and then they could fake their way home. So in those cases, you need to look at encrypting the beacons. But by and large, it's not a challenge, not an issue.
That's interesting. So we talked a bit about the technology. Let's make sure that people really understand the solution. So there's a blue dot location. There's navigation, which is about having an arrow and go this way to find the where the shops are in the airport, so you can spend money and we can take our percentage. And there's analytics. What sort of analytics are people typically looking at?
Analytics is very sector specific.
It's
really interesting. So each sector has a very particular thing they want to do with location analytics. To give you a couple of examples, airports, my favorite example is one of our airport clients will, so it's not using Bluetooth, it's actually using Wi-Fi positioning. They will see, they will look at the gate where you board the flight. They will see which devices are around that gate, and then they will look through the record that we'll have collected throughout the airport to see where that device has been and how long it's spent at each sector of the airport. So what that means is when that person entered, did they spend more than 20 minutes queuing at check-in? Did they spend more than 20 minutes in the security? And then as a consequence, did they have no time to spend in duty-free? And so you can make a really neat ROI calculation that says, if I have one extra person at check-in, I can reduce the queue by X minutes per person, which leaves X more minutes in duty-free. And then these duty-free shops, they make a fortune out of passengers going through, and they measure it in terms of, you know, there's the golden hour concept. So any extra minute of time that you can get a passenger to spend in duty free is, you know, tangible dollars in sales. So by looking at that, they can build up a profile to say, you know, this flight to Singapore versus this flight to Rio. I know that if I add one person extra check-in, I can generate $20,000 over the course of this month, or you know, $240,000 over the course of the year. It's a lot of money when you work it back. It really is an impressive ROI. That's airports. Then in retail, it's about footfall. It's one of my favorite examples is when it's raining, which door do people use to come into the shopping mall? Do they come in through the main car park, or do they come in through the metro? And so can I configure the where I put my advertising or my events or my seating or my, you know, all that stuff based around that? And then of course, if they did go to a particular area, like, so if I'm a mall manager and I hire a band to play for an hour, the people who came to that area of the mall, where did they go after that? Did they just go home, or did they go to Zara and spend 20 minutes looking at clothes?
That's fascinating. But so in a sense, you're competing against the camera infrastructure, are you not, in that sort of case? Because I can use my camera infrastructure to look at the flow of people and make same information, isn't it?
Camera infrastructure is fantastic. And if there's two things holding you back with camera infrastructure. The first is cost. It's very expensive. And then the second is data privacy, because you can recognize a face. And so in a lot of places, you're not, strictly speaking, allowed to track an individual as they walk around without their prior consent, which you can't really get in many of these environments.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
But you can, if it's an app, then you can ask for their consent. If it's a camera, then how do you do that? Come on, do it.
That's it, yeah. Of course, a camera is more accurate. You get centimeter accuracy with a camera, and the coverage is also going to be better.
100%. You get every person can be seen by the camera, although maybe you don't have 100% coverage of everywhere with the camera, whereas you might arguably, I don't know.
With beacons.
It's an interesting argument, yeah.
But again, like many of our clients deploy both solutions. So airports often have a camera.
Well, and I guess the other thing is, potentially, if you have an app, then you can get all sorts of demographics. You can start to learn about the customer over time and how often they've come back and where they went, which shops they went into over time. And then how there's all sorts of things that you can do if you have it integrated into the app and that app is learning as long as they've opted in.
Absolutely. That's a big part of it. Understanding loyalty, understanding of people coming back, and where do they spend their time.
So what about this asset tracking thing? You do that as well, because that's almost a completely different use case, isn't it?
So it is the flip side, where you have a tag which broadcasts, you know, a Bluetooth tag which broadcasts a signal, which is then collected by a gateway. the gateway sends that data to a cloud, crunches it, and puts a position on the on top of an admin dashboard. That's the main principle. It's something that we typically do as an add-on to our core service around the SDK proposition. For example, when we're working with hardware that enables you to do both, so some of the cooler later bits of Wi-Fi hardware will let you do asset tracking and beaconing at the same time.
What are some examples of that?
So there are some lighting, I think in lighted hardware, we can configure it so that we can do both. It's possible with some brands of Wi-Fi to configure it. I think it's possible with Cisco as well, but don't hold me to that.
Right.
To be able to configure them separately. And then, of course, there are some areas where we just have two different sets of infrastructure. So we've got a standalone gateway and a standalone beacon when we put them.
Well, you mentioned Cisco, and we've had them on the Mr. Beacon podcast quite a few times. So I'm just trying to think. It's at least three times, maybe four. And so we looked at DNA spaces, and I was very interested to see that you and DNA Spaces, you have a partnership. Cisco have been promoting Pointer, but it seems like they want to make money out of location and you want to make money out of location. So I'm kind of surprised that you're cooperating rather than competing. I got it the right way around. I'm surprised you're cooperating and not competing.
I could understand that. So we're really enjoying the partnership and the collaboration that we have with Cisco at the moment. It's proving super fruitful. And I think for both parties, it revolves around, let's say, two of our core products. The first is the Blue Dot, the SDK based Blue Dot. So having a Blue Dot created with a mobile phone, which is something that, a lot of companies have tried, but few have managed to do reliably and consistently without having an internet connection all the time on the device. And so I think in the past we've probably competed with Cisco on certain opportunities where they would have provided a Blue Dot. And so it's great to see that over time it's still the point of Blue Dot that's successful in delivering a good positioning. So that's the first area. There are many clients that use DNA Spaces that already have floor plans integrated into DNA Spaces that we can then pull down and turn into maps and then deliver Blue Dot into the client's app. So, two things. The first is the Blue Dot. The second, which uses the beacons inside the Cisco APs. And then the second is mapping. And I think this is where it really gets interesting. So we have our new MapScale product that we've been doing lots of promotion of recently that is around AI I hate to use these sort of buzzwords, but like an AI-based mapping solution. And that's where it gets interesting. Cisco has DNA Spaces has hundreds of millions of square feet of floor space covered with APs, and they have floor plans. They know where the APs are in the building, and then they have clients who want to get more out of their offices or more out of their malls, and that requires accurate, up-to-date maps that can be produced at ridiculous scale, at ridiculous speed, and then have a Blue Dot that they can essentially just turn on because we know where all the APs are. So we take the floor plans. Floor plans, as I'm sure you've seen, have loads and loads of junk all over them. They've got hatching, they've got text, they've got all kinds of layers and stuff that you need to get rid of. Yeah. And MapScale will essentially remove all of that junk on top of the floor plan in an automated way. So we've trained it based on, you know, thousands of CAD files of the R&D team. You know, they've done an amazing job of training MapScale to get rid of all the junk that you don't want and then just leave the walls. I mean, walls are tricky, right? Walls on floor plans often don't actually intersect on a digital wall plan, on a digital floor plan. So having a computer deduce that actually these are a wall that are connected is not a straightforward task. And then tables or pot plants, how do you distinguish that from like a big desk from a little desk, stuff like that? It's all very, very difficult to do. And when you're talking hundreds of millions of square feet, as these guys are, you have to be very smart at it. So MapScale does all that. Sorry, that I'm babbling a bit, but MapScale.
No, it's interesting. So MapScale's your product, is it?
Yeah.
That's just to be clear. Yeah.
That's right.
A component of your product. Yeah.
So okay. Yeah, it's our latest mapping product. So it will take those floor plans for those, you know, 100,000 venue clients that exist out there, and then produce nice, pretty 3D maps based on that automatically.
Cool. And so why is it that Cisco DNA Spaces has these maps? If I'm sticking access points up, I wouldn't have thought I need details of where the plants and the doors are. I just kind of I'd need very rudimentary information.
Well, that's right. But the information that comes to them will be the original floor plan that's produced by the architect.
Interesting. Of course. Makes sense.
So that's what gets uploaded to, you know, sometimes you just get PNG, you get all sorts of crazy stuff in the CAD files that you have to filter out. It's a very difficult problem.
Very cool.
I'm very proud of. Sorry.
Well, before we wrap up, I just want to kind of pick your brains about any specific trends you see in verticals. We've talked a bit about airports, a bit about shopping malls. What about healthcare? What's happening there? Is that, what are the verticals that, how would you, the momentum in different verticals and specifically healthcare, which is kind of the perennial favorite of our industry, where does that fit in it?
So at the moment, the real driver for indoor positioning is actually workplace, it's offices, it's desk booking, it's making sure that everybody on your team can see where the new meeting room is, and more importantly, that they can access it, right? So if you're booking a big team meeting and you have somebody, for example, in a wheelchair, you need to make sure that that person also can, you know, participate. And that's getting more and more complicated with hybrid workplaces. So that's where we're seeing the big drive.
And so this would be like a big company that has many offices. Like we have Qualcomm here, and they name their buildings after letters of the alphabet. And there's also a building K, which is actually Carl Strauss. So that's a bit of inside baseball. But they ran out of letters, and so they went to double letters. So many buildings. It would be a company like that, presumably, where you get invited to a meeting in another building you've never been to it before, even though it's just 2 miles down the road. And then, are people, is that only for companies that have their own app? I don't even know whether Qualcomm has its own app.
It's something that we're asking ourselves every day is about who owns the app, where does the app belong to? Is it the company? Is there a third? So it's a whole ecosystem. It's massive. There are companies who develop their own apps, such as Microsoft for workplace. I mean, it's unsurprising, you're a big software company, they develop their own app to do that. Whereas there are other companies that will buy in an app from CBRE Host or Comfy by Siemens or ISS. Or there's a host of different workplace experience apps out there. And then they often have different tiers of service that they provide to their clients, or And location is often one of those tiers. So a big client or a big campus, that's where they really see value. Like for example, the one that you mentioned, Qualcomm, with many, many different buildings. You know, it's not our client, but that would be a great example of a place where having a map, being able to do indoor-outdoor transition as we do across a campus or just indoors, all that stuff is really sort of important for them.
And have you been hit by, in that respect, have you been hit by the coronavirus? People don't need to find the meeting room because the meeting room is their bedroom.
So it's the other way around.
Really?
These companies are desperate to get people back into their offices because real estate is expensive. And you know, we were talking earlier, for example, the luxuries that you have in order to keep people interested.
This was before we recorded, so just in case anyone's missed it, Williot's San Diego offices, we have amazing luxuries here. The best coffee machine,
actually, champagne,
open. We have beer in the fridge. The yoga studio. Anyway, I'll stop promoting us, but go to Williot's careers page and you can see how you can get free yoga classes, beer and sandwiches from the coffee shop. Anyway, back to, away from that commercial break for our sponsor and back to you. That what you just described is a real eye opener, that COVID actually is a driver for your business. That's amazing. I hadn't thought about that.
It's for all sectors. I mean, airports and retail are also looking to differentiate themselves to as people start to go back into the, to go back.
Yeah.
In London, I go out and it's like it's back to normal again. All these places are absolutely packed and they're at full competition again. Offices, I think, maybe a bit less so. But then again, it's even more important because offices are changing. They meeting rooms, there are more meeting rooms and fewer desks now. So people who knew where their desk used to be don't necessarily have one anymore. They've completely changed the layout of offices to match what people want, which is more interactive space.
And maybe a desk sharing as well. People are trying to optimize, as you say, fewer desks, everyone shares. Therefore, you need to know, how can I find that desk that's free? I guess
that's it.
And I have to say, we're seeing what that phenomenon that you described. Retailers, we all went into lockdown. We learned how to use Amazon, even our grannies and mums and dads, the people who were technophobic before. And so now retailers are having to compete with the online experience. And so they're going to IoT technologies to do that.
I mean, I'll give you just quickly one amazing example from a new client. I'm not sure if I'm allowed to name them or not yet. In the UAE, which is developing a smart parking system that will analyze where you've been in the shopping mall. It will see which, using our technology, it will see which stores you've been to, where you went, to deduce your preferences. And then when you turn up at the shopping mall in your car, the LED display will say, go to floor 3, section A, park in B22. And so that when you get out of your car, you'll be next to the shops that you want to go to, which I think is awesome. It's such a, that's a real kind of future of retail application.
That's very good. So we talked about verticals. I asked you about healthcare. We ended up talking about retail, which is fascinating to me. So I don't regret that. But do you see business in healthcare, or is that not?
No. Healthcare is big. So we have one fantastic client in Colorado, UC Health, that is a large hospital campus where we're deployed in their mobile app to provide positioning. And I think maps, but maybe not sure yet. So in there, their users will navigate For example, I have an appointment today. So I get a notification through my UC Health app telling me that I need to go to this building at this time. So firstly, it will tell me which car park to go to in order so that you're closest to your building. Then from the car park, we'll do the GPS-based navigation to the front door. At the front door, we'll have a, you know, from the user's point of view, a seamless transition to Bluetooth beacons. There'll be a notification as you turn up saying, you know, welcome to the hospital. Your doctor is on floor 3 in room 602. Click here to navigate. So it will take them to the elevator, go up the elevator, get out the elevator, and then, you know, walk to the doctor's office. So that, for I think a lot of patients, is a pretty important kind of innovation or a useful innovation for them. Healthcare is growing right now, especially in the US, where, you know, healthcare is, it's not like in the UK, where in the UK you kind of go to the doctor that you have to go to, right? You don't choose your doctor, you don't choose your hospital, you don't choose your surgeon. Whereas in the US, these hospitals, they compete, or the healthcare centers, healthcare systems, they compete with one another in order to get your business. And a quality app that will allow you to schedule your appointments, to learn about your doctor, to learn about your treatment, and then help you on that journey is a real winner for patients. And a real winner for
patients. Yeah, and I just getting people in and out and making sure they turn up on time and that sort of thing's got to have an ROI as well. So I hope that this improves, just as a consumer of those services that badly need improvement. Last topic, competition. Of course, Apple Maps, Google Maps do have an indoor offering. How do you compete with that?
This is one of our interview questions when we're interviewing people. How do we compete against Google offering AR? So Google won't give you user data. They keep it for themselves. If you are a retailer, that's what you're interested in. You're interested in keeping your user data in the app. If you are a hospital, you can't share your patient's location data with a third party. It has to be owned. And if you're a workplace, if you're a big bank, you can't have a large tech company knowing where you are in that building. So, or where your people are, how long they spend, who's with each other, what are they doing in the meeting rooms, that sort of thing. It's far too invasive. So the data, it's really about data ownership, who owns the data. There's also a product aspect to it that the Apple location is based on, is essentially a fingerprinting solution, which will degrade over time. And the Google solution, I believe, is image-based, which is okay. But then you've got your camera on all the time, which again is a bit of can be considered by some as an invasion of privacy, potentially.
So that makes sense in terms of why, as a shopping mall, I want the data. So there's all sorts of integrations that I want to control. So that makes sense. But what about, you're also competing for the consumer, the end user, right? Why would the end user bother to go to the shopping mall to do the navigation versus just use the app that they use to get to the mall in the first place?
Well, so those shopping mall apps or airport apps will often have lots of other benefits or features or loyalty or, for example, we were talking earlier about getting you to the right car park. In, if you go to the UAE or even in the US, these car parks are enormous. Getting you to the one that then helps you have the best experience, that's really important to a lot of end users. And it would be the same in like an aviation story as well as a workplace story. Helping the user save time and giving them plenty of benefits while they're at it.
Very good. So, Paul, I was looking at your LinkedIn resume, as is my wont before these things, and you've got an interesting you've had an interesting path up until working at Pointer, and you've actually been involved in making movies and working in China. And how did you end up getting this job? What was your path? What did you study at college, and how did you get to Pointer?
It's been fun. So I did physics up in St. Andrews, and physics is a great subject because it
opens that's Scotland, right? For people that don't know,
exactly, up in the north. And it's a great subject because it opens loads of different doors into all sorts of different places. And then I went off to do optics in France at another university to do a master's. And then around that time, I discovered I also really loved learning Chinese. And so
how do you just happen to discover that you like learning Chinese?
I don't know. You just
when you're in France.
I suppose it was when I was in Scotland, but I had a bit of time and I saw there was a class, and so I just took it up. I enjoyed languages anyway, and I took up that, and I really enjoyed the cultural aspect of it and the language aspect of it. Following that, I actually found Chinese probably more interesting than physics, and so ended up moving to Taiwan firstly and started studying Chinese, which is great, at the NTU. Mm-hmm. And I found a fantastic job selling lasers, buying them in China and then selling them in the West, and so that's how I got into sales. And then I expanded. I went to China, to Shanghai, where I did loads of technical sales for, essentially it was a consultancy that does your biz dev in Asia. And so I took on loads of good projects. One of those was actually working for the SIG, for BT SIG, where we were representing them.
Really?
And helping them find opportunities in China. And so I actually worked quite closely with Chuck Sabin during that time.
So what sort of opportunities is the Bluetooth SIG looking for in China?
So understanding what the future of Bluetooth looks like. All the devices making Bluetooth, or a good majority of them, are manufactured in China. And so, of course, the SIG takes has its revenue based on devices being manufactured and making sure that they understand what the future is, what factories are producing, what the big companies are producing. It was really interesting. We got to go to loads of large corporates as well as smaller companies to see what they're doing with Bluetooth. So a great introduction to the technology.
Amazing.
It was great. And then after that, it's not so relevant to Pointer, but at the same time, a friend and I started the company doing VR film production. Which was great fun around China. We took drones and strapped VR cameras to them and flew them around. We got a film put into the French company hired us, and we got a film put at Cannes, which is awesome. And then I via New Zealand came back to the UK, and was looking for a technical sales role. Ideally in IoT, because I really enjoy IoT. I think it's an emerging, I don't know if it's emerging anymore, but it's a really interesting.
It's growing. It's certainly influential. It's impactful, changing our lives.
Yeah, I suppose it's sort of that point between emerging and everywhere where it is. Yeah, it's growing, it's scaling. I got introduced to Ege at Pointer, and then I went from there. So I've been sort of leading technical sales or a lot of the sales, particularly outside the US, but also some in the US for Pointer since then. It's been a fun
fascinating journey. And what about this movie that you made that went to Cannes? You were the producer, or?
Well, so we shot. So the film was two French directors who were hired by, do you know Arte, the TV channel? So they were hired by Arte to do to film. They call it fake cities. They called it the real thing. The film. It was about fake copies of European cities in China. So we took shots of a fake Paris with a fake Eiffel Tower, a fake London with a fake Big Ben and Tower Bridge, and then a fake Vienna with gondolas. Venice with gondolas.
Venice.
Yeah. And
that's amazing. Most people have no idea that talk about copying and plagiarism, intellectual property theft, they're stealing whole cities now. Well, it's amazing.
The focus of the film was on the people who lived in these cities. So if you go to the fake Paris, you've got a fake Champs-Élysées with these enormous buildings. There's a famous music video. There's a DJ called Jamie XX who did a song called Gosh. And if you look at the video on YouTube, you'll see that city. It's incredible. They've got the fake Eiffel Tower, which is a third the height, and they've got all these people who are living there, and they interview them, asking them about what's it like? Does living on the Champs-Élysées impact the way of life? You know, there's these ladies sort of hanging their underpants outside the balcony facing the Eiffel Tower. It's really interesting. And so we had some drones, some big drones, and we put a beast sort of 6 GoPro unit on the bottom, suspended from a meter high rod, and then took some really nice shots going through there. Which were used in the film. So
amazing. And it's also in virtual reality and regular.
Yeah, regular. In the VR world, I think the film was quite a big hit. It won a couple of awards. We only did some shots for it, but it was great fun.
Amazing. Very good. And so does music kind of intertwine into this interesting life that you've had in a meaningful way? Is it important to you or not?
I enjoy music. I guess so. I've not played much music since I was a kid, really. But I've always enjoyed going to gigs and things.
And so what are your three favorite songs then and why?
Well, so I thought long and hard about it. I don't know if I have three favorite, but I thought of three happy songs. I think whenever I listen to, cheer me up. And I guess the first is "Piano Man" by Billy Joel. I think it's just this happy memory of being in the U.S. with my brother, on a road trip.
Oh, really? But where'd you go?
All around California, and the classic Southwest road trip. We went to Burning Man and a few other places. I shouldn't mention.
Did you make it down to San Diego, where I am?
No, we didn't make it to San Diego. Where we got it. Death Valley, and then north up to Nevada. And
all right. Yeah, very good. So that's Piano Man is number one. Great story behind it. What's number two?
Number two, I suppose. I was thinking. So I have a 1-year-old, and we discovered that she loves it when we sing Gangnam Style to her. every time we sing Gangnam Style, it's always a happy, a happy moment. So I'd say that's wonderful. Definitely up there.
Yeah, that's a great choice.
And I suppose lastly is another happy memory in Shanghai, when I was first starting and I was living with, I somehow wound up in a flat full of 14 English teachers, in downtown Shanghai, just rowdy American English teachers, and every evening they had a tradition of singing "Wagon Wheel" by Darius Rucker. And so I think when you get into the spirit of that would be the third sort of happy memory I have, and the third song that came to me when I was thinking
very cool. Very cool. Thanks so much for that. That's wonderful. I have one unusual request for you. Never asked a guest to do this before.
Okay.
Dramatic effect. Could you say something along the lines of, to all our Chinese viewers and listeners, thanks very much for following Mr. Beacon. Please tell your friends and subscribe. Say that in Chinese.
Sure. 感谢我们中国的粉丝, 就是, one second, I might take me a couple of goes to get this. 感谢我们, Mr. Beacon, no, hang on. 感谢我们在中国, Mr. Beacon的粉丝, 请大家点个赞。
Thank you so much.
No problem.
That's great. What a great way to end the interview.
I want to thank Aaron Hammond for his work on production, Jesse Hazelrig, our producer. I want to thank you for listening. Please do like us, tell your friends about us, and please join us for the next time we meet up.